Welcome to the Proper Mental Podcast. Normalizing open and honest conversations about mental health by having open and honest conversations about mental health. Hello and welcome to Proper Mental, episode 180, and my guest this week is Andrew Jenkins, who is a mental health advocate and public speaker, and you might recognise him off the telly, because earlier this year, he is one of the stars of the BBC series The Traitors, where he actually made the final, and Andrew provided some quite moving scenes throughout his time on the show, where he talked about his experiences with mental health, and that's exactly what he joins me today to talk all about, because at the age of 21, Andrew was in a car accident that left him pronounced dead at the side of the road. And he actually spent 5 weeks in a coma. And when he woke up, he was told that he might not even recognise his family or be able to walk again. And the impact that this had on his sense of self and his identity and his life in general would lead to a lot of struggles with his mental health. And they would last for about 20 odd years before Andrew was able to get some help and guidance with his mental state and begin to grieve for the life that he believed that he'd lost. And in this episode, I chat to Andrew about his life growing up in Wales before the crash and the immediate aftermath. We talk about the impact that this event had on his mental health and why he suffered in silence for so many years. And we chat about how he got help, how he got better, and how this is all driving him to do the work that he does now and the impact that his work is having. And of course, we chat all about The Traitors. We talk about things like men's mental health and grief and building self-awareness. And we talk about how hard it can be to tell your family that you love them, but why it's so, so important to do so. I'm a big fan of The Traitors. I think it's a great show and I really enjoyed watching Andrew on there. He's a really authentic guy, you know, what you see is what you get. And that was very much the case when I met him. He's exactly the same as he was on the telly. Just a really lovely and funny and caring guy. And it was really cool to chat to him. I've really enjoyed watching all the different things that he's been doing since coming off the show. You know, he suddenly found himself in this position where he has a really big platform and he seems determined to use that for good. You know, he's really doing some wonderful things. And I just think that needs to be applauded, really. We live in a world that is so driven by celebrity culture and influencers and the amount of followers you have on social media and the size of your platform. That seems to be everything. And I find a lot of the mental health stuff in this space really tokenistic. That might be quite cynical of me, but it seems like often when someone's got a book out, they might tell a little sad story for a 2-minute clip in the hope of going viral. And it's just, well, it's not for me. People can do whatever they like, right? But it's just not for me. And chatting to Andrew and hearing about the passion that he has for this stuff and the difference that he is making for people and how he's using the platform and using his voice in this space, it's just a wonderful, wonderful thing. And it was a real pleasure to chat to him. Big shout out to Mark Williams for introducing us and putting this together. Mark, of course, was on a few episodes back. So if you like hearing episodes about men's mental health, particularly Welsh lads from the valleys, that's another great episode. Mark's done some incredible things over the years, so that's worth a listen as well. And of course, if you want to watch this episode or my episode with Mark or any episodes at all, you can do so on the Proper Mental Patreon page, where you can sign up to be a proper mentalist. And all that means is you get early access to episodes, you get the videos that don't come up anywhere else, you get to submit questions for upcoming guests, and most importantly, you get to keep this show going. I'm fully independent. I don't have ads. I don't have sponsors. I want to be able to just do what I want to do when I want to do it. And most importantly, just to keep going, to keep having these conversations, and maybe they can make a difference to the people that need to hear them. And hopefully you enjoy them too. And if that's not worth £3, I don't know what is. So the link to all that is in the episode notes. You can, of course, support as well by leaving a review wherever you are listening to this podcast. And this is episode 180 of the Proper Mental Podcast. And my guest is Andrew Jenkins. Thank you very much for listening. Enjoy. Wonderful. I'll intro this episode, mate, and we can dive straight in.
Fab noise.
So here we are with another episode of the Proper Mental Podcast. And my guest this week is Andrew Jenkins. How are you, mate?
Yeah, very well. Thanks for the invite, Tom. I appreciate it.
Oh, mate, it's lovely to meet you. I'm really surprised, actually, that we made this happen, because it seems like since Traitors finished, you have not sat still for a single second, mate. How's it been? You've been everywhere.
It's been brilliant, to be honest. And yeah, to be honest, I'll make time for things like this because I think it's something important to me and something close to my heart. So yeah, the more people I get out and speak to, the better. So your podcast will give me the platform to speak to thousands of people because, yeah, it's been crazy the last couple of weeks. It's all been very, very good, to be honest. And it can be a little bit overwhelming sometimes, but I've obviously got to get some structure back in my life. And, you know, and it's all good. It's all positive. It's really good.
Yeah, I suppose it's a really tricky balance between like making the most of the opportunities and then not like burning your candle at both ends and completely blowing it up, right? It sounds like it's quite challenging to get the balance.
That's right. Yeah, I like to say yes to people as well. I want to speak to as many people as possible. I don't like saying no, which is, I feel like we're a fraud sometimes. They talk about mental health and well-being. I need to look after my own mental health and well-being as well. So, yeah, the first couple of weeks were crazy, but now I'm getting a bit more structure in place now and saying no. I can only do these things. So saying no to someone is not a bad thing. I do a lot of talks, inspirational, motivational talks. And one of the things in there I say is, it's not bad to say no. So I've started now the last couple of weeks to say no to people or I can't do it this time. And, you know, it's good.
Yeah, it's a hard thing, isn't it, saying no? We have to kind of, it takes a bit of figuring out. And I always find I have to keep reminding myself. So at times I think I'm really good at it. And I'm like, no, my boundaries are good this month. And then next thing you know, I'm knackered like a couple of months later. And I'm thinking, why do I feel like shit? And it's like, oh yeah, because I stopped saying no to stuff. Like we have to keep reminding ourselves, don't we, to stay with it.
No, you do 100%. And obviously the pillars in my life as well are the gym, eating healthy and everything. So over the last couple of weeks, they've gone out the window. They're back to reintroduce the things that are important to me, which help my mental health as well. So the first couple of weeks were crazy. And it's reintroduce the things back in your life, that, you know, good pillars of good mental health, really. So that's what I started doing that the last week or so.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. They are, aren't they? When life gets busy, they are the first things that tend to go the stuff that we re-rely on. Yeah, it's a tricky... Yeah, yeah. Tricky balance. Mate, we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves here. I want to rewind a little bit. I want to go all the way back, mate, because I there must be a bit of feeling with you at the moment that like these opportunities that you're getting, you know, that you've made for yourself, that things like this do not happen to working class lads from South Wales, right? There must be that kind of like feel to it almost. But, you know, that's where I wanted to go back to. I wanted to go back to kind of back to the beginning and where did you grow up and all that sort of stuff, mate?
Yeah, well, I was born... 1978. I know you'll look. I look a lot older, probably at the moment. But I don't. 1978. Born in a traditional Welsh family. My mother and father hardworking, great role models. My dad worked hard at a factory. My mother worked in a bank actually. Then she gave up work then to have my oldest brother Simon. And she didn't go back to work then until my youngest brother Carl was old enough to look after himself. So you know, the traditional, typical British family, I suppose. You've got to work hard in life. Make sure you do these sort of things and structure. You know, parents never driven a car before, either of my parents. They'd never be on holiday. They have the same food every day. So they're really lovely people, loving people, but they're really old-fashioned, traditional. So I grew up in that environment. Obviously, two older brothers, one younger brother as well. So very competitive household, very sporty. The testosterone in my house was just ridiculous. So all rugby boys as well. I grew up the same as lots of people in Wales, I suppose. My dream was to play rugby for Wales. They put on the red jersey. And from 5 years of age, 21, that was my dream, really, to represent Wales and run out in front of the National Stadium. So my upbringing, I had a great upbringing, a loving family, but the biggest thing was we just didn't talk about feelings and emotions. You're a big, hard, strong man. You can't show any feelings. I was never told that by my parents, but that's just, you just assume the environment you're in. You assume if you talk or show feelings, you're not a real man, you're weak. So I grew up in that household, really.
Yeah, it's so funny you say it, and I like identify with that so much, you know, like these things are never said to us, right? No one ever said to me, don't share your feelings, don't show weak. No one ever said it. I wasn't taught it, but it's just like, it's in the, I don't know, it's sort of in the atmosphere, in the DNA. You just put on these shields and the, you know, build this shell up, but it's, no one tells you to do it. We just kind of do it, right? It's such a strange thing. I can almost like, can't quite find the words for it, Andrew, to be honest, but do you know what I mean? Where I'm getting at with that?
No, 100%. That's what I, you know, I grew up, my parents were brilliant. They never said anything bad to me, but they didn't really say anything good to me either. They never said, oh, we love you, or well done, we're proud of you. So I grew up like thinking the only way really to show my parents, or get my parents' love and affection or be proud, was playing rugby, winning rugby matches, being the best on the field, winning trophies and that sort of thing. And then when I lost that at 21, then I really struggled. I lost my identity completely as a rugby boy. I lost my complete identity of, you know, 21 years as a rugby person. I lost that completely. So, but see, my family are amazing. You know, the competitiveness in my household, having two brothers, you know, losing a rugby match wasn't I didn't mind losing a rugby match. It was going home and seeing my brothers and having the mick taken out of me for ages and ages. That was the worst bit, really. But it's crazy. I laugh about it now, but it was terrible because all my life, I wouldn't do anything, wouldn't take part in anything that I wouldn't be good at. So I was so scared of failure or not winning. You know, I was even when my son was born, for example, his school sports day race, the Father's Day race in the school sports, I wouldn't do it. Then there was two boys there bet quicker than me. I knew I'd lose. So he'd come over every year and get me, come for his Father's Day race. I was saying, nah, I got a bad leg this year. Or I'd go in my suit purposely from work, knowing I couldn't do it. I was so scared of failure. So when I look back on my life, I missed out on so many opportunities. I was so scared of having to go and go out of my comfort zone and trying.
Yeah, that's crikey. That's so much of my story, that, Andrew, like so much. You know, I was a drinker, right? And drink for me allowed me, it gave me the courage and the confidence to do those things that I didn't do. But I'm the same. I look back at my life and there's so many things I said no to because I wasn't going to be the best, because I wasn't going to win, and I think that's really, really common. It's such a blokey thing, isn't it? Right. It's such a, and it's very easy to style that stuff out because you can kind of, you can be cool with it, right? So you can turn stuff down and make out that it's, oh, you know, I'm too cool for that. You know, I'm too arrogant for that. I'm too much of a lad for that. So you don't ever have to drop that shell to turn that stuff down. You know, you can keep the facade up quite easily, can't you?
I wore a mask basically all my life, pretty much all my life. I wore a mask, you know, pretend to be so hidden by my rugby boy mask or my rugby career mask, whatever. And, you know, I say, I know, and it's pretty much most people do. The only way you learn and grow is by failing and losing things in life. I learned a lot more from the things I've lost in my life than I have from winning in a rugby match by 80 points. Nobody learns from that. I learned more from the matches I lost than the matches I won, to be honest. You know, in the gym, I learned more from the things I didn't achieve in the gym than I did by the things by lifting all of that. So, yeah, I in my talks I do now, you know, I'm telling people, well, we need to get better as a nation, you know, teachers, parents. We need to get better at teaching the kids. Losing is part of life. You can't get away from losing. It's what you do with that loss. That's what counts. My partner, my previous partner, her son, for example, went to a football tournament last year. He's 9 years of age. And he came up from the tournament and said, did anybody win the tournament? And he said, oh, no, everybody won. I said, what do you mean everybody won? Oh, we all had medals. I said, how, explain that to me, I said, because if you score three goals and they score no goals, you don't win. I said, I can't comprehend that. Please explain that to me. And I understand that, you know, getting kids involved is important. They've got to enjoy it and all that sort of thing. But also, there's a certain point of time in life where winning is part of life. I say, what happens with that nine-year-old then in the future when he's 20 years of age, loses his girlfriend, loses his job? What's he going to do? Give up and cry? I said, that's when you get better. That's what people say to me. How do you build resilience? How are you strong? I said, I've lost things in life. I've lost my job. I've lost my girlfriend. I've lost things in the gym. I've lost my weight training. I've learned from that. I sit back and learn from that.
Yeah. If we make things too easy, then it's like it's setting, particularly with children, right? It's setting them up to fail. It's not giving them the tools, you know, and you see it a lot these days, particularly with like social media, and everyone's trying to be perfect on social media. And if life is absolutely perfect for a child, well, life is it like outside of life isn't perfect, is it? So, you know, they need to, I always think this with like, when I'm showing emotion and things like that, and I always think like, yeah, sometimes I make bad parenting decisions and I might like snap at one of my kids. I might behave in a way that I feel bad about afterwards. But in its own way, that's important too. And if I deal with that, right, if I go to my son and say, look, I'm really sorry, that wasn't your fault. You know, daddy should not have behaved that way.
Perfect,
but it's also important for him to see me lose my shit, because when he wants to lose his shit, you know, like he knows it's okay to do that too and let out his emotions and express himself, you know? So it's like, you bang on there. We can't make it too easy, right? We can't all win because someone has to not win.
Lose is part of life, isn't it? Unfortunately, you might lose a loved one. You're going to lose something at one point. You know, you can't go through the whole. I don't think I know anybody in my life who's gone through the. I know a lot of successful businessmen, sports people, celebrities, and I can guarantee they'll all tell you they've lost lots of things. Or you see all these businessmen, for example, Jeff Bezos, Richard Branson. They've all failed in life. But it's just having been not scared to fail, really, and just have a. I think we need to break the stigma that's out there. We're losing is a bad thing. You know, I think it's so, people are so scared. It's such a stigma out there. We're thinking, people get laughed at, and losing is this, and you need to stop doing that, really, and tell people losing is good. It's not a bad thing.
Yeah, and one of the things you can kind of, you know, is that it's not that bad at all. That's a really important lesson to kind of lose at a football match or something when you're young. So, oh, hang on a minute, nothing's changed. Like, I'm still, you know, I'm still all right. My mum and dad still love me, whatever it is, you know.
Perfect.
But that's a big lesson, right?
You hit the nail on the head then. Your mum and dad still love you. So if you lose or don't achieve something in life, your parents, your loved ones, people close to you, they're not going to think any less of you. They're going to love you exactly the same. Whereas, like, when I lost my identity in rugby, I really struggled with it. I didn't think my dad was proud of me anymore. I really struggled with that sort of thing, you know. But, you know, I don't know. In the conversation, this could come on further on a podcast. But I've done things. I put things in place. Being self-aware is really important as well. And obviously, you sound like you're self-aware. When you do lose your shit, you say to your son, I'm sorry. And, you know, it's good that kids can see people do make mistakes, and it's how you correct that. You know, rather than you being stubborn and not apologizing to your son and then they're festering and going on, you go to him and you say sorry, and you put things right in place then. So you can see, well, yeah, dad is wrong, but he has come and apologized to me. So you can be wrong in life. It's not a bad thing. As long as you can admit it, or as long as you can see why you were wrong in the first place.
Yeah, definitely. It's hard to learn this stuff, like self-awareness. It never really stops, does it? And like whenever I think I've kind of mastered it, I'm like, oh, I'm leveling up here. Then usually something happens in my life that I think, oh, crap, maybe I'm not as self-aware as I thought. But it's an ongoing journey, right? To keep exploring this stuff and to keep trying to make positive changes. I suppose, like, particularly with parenting is that, I suppose you kind of alluded to it when you were saying about your family before, is that what we're starting to realize now, I think, is that knowing that you're loved is not enough. You kind of have to be told a little bit, right? So my family, my wife and my kids, we're an I love you family. We say it a lot in this house, but growing up, we didn't say it in my house. You know, it's only in the last few years I've started practicing saying it to my parents, and it's hard. You know, it kind of, especially with my dad, it sticks in my throat a little bit. It makes me feel a bit funny. It makes me feel like an anxious, shy little kid again, you know? But I think in older generations, if there was a happy household, they maybe assumed that it was taken for granted that everyone knew they were loved. That's how I see my house, right? Because we were happy, we were fine. So no one needed to say it, but you do need to say it, don't you? You need to say, I love you.
That's exactly like, you sound similar to me, to be honest, my upbringing. I think the way my mother and father got to show their love, my mother is make somebody food, is food is the way of showing their love. So if I'm having a problem or a down day, I have something to eat, I'll make you a nice cup. If this food is there, when my mother's way of showing she loves me, I suppose. And I, you know, and that's the same. And like my dad, my mum and dad, I'm the same as you. I broke the cycle last year. My son is 22 years of age, and I had a conversation with him last year, an open and honest conversation for 4.5 hours. And I said to him at the end of the conversation, I love you, and I'm proud of you no matter what. It's the first time I've told my son in 22 years I loved him. 22 years it took me to say it to my son. And I hugged him, and I said, I hugged you. I hugged him since he's a baby, probably. He's a big guy like me, a rugby boy as well. So we had a coffee in a coffee shop in Cardiff. And I said, I love you no matter what. I'm proud of you no matter what you do in life. I don't care if you play rugby. I don't care. As long as you're a good person, you're happy. I don't care how big your house is, what car you're driving. I don't give a shit about that. It's you as a person. That's all I care about. So I'm hoping I took a bit of pressure off him. I'm hoping I broke the cycle in my family, the generational cycle in my family. You know, it's funny because, like you just said then, when I've never, it's hard to say to my mother and father now that I love them. My mother got upset the other day, and my partner then said, I'll give your mother a hug. And I just couldn't, I wanted to, in my stomach, I wanted to, but something was like a knot in my stomach saying, I felt so awkward doing it. It felt just unnatural. It was really weird. So, and I'm talking about it now to people, but I'm not perfect. I find it hard to say to my mother and father, I never told my brothers I love them. Even now I haven't told them. So it's hard. You just want to break the cycle and do it more and more. Once you start doing it, me and my son do it all the time now. It feels good.
Yeah, it's just practice, isn't it? It's just practice. And you know, it's like losing, you know, you get better at it. You get good at it. Yeah. I've been doing this thing in the last sort of couple of years, really, like through my therapy is, you know, you mentioned before, you know, like not doing stuff for fear of losing. And I've been kind of revisiting times in my life where I chose not to do something I wanted to do because I was scared of what other people think. And even sometimes they're like really small stuff that at the time was massive. So, you know, maybe when I was a kid, I saved up my paper round money and I bought this, like, you know, like a sports top or a jumper or something, and then wore it once and someone said something at school. And then so you don't wear it again. But I'd wanted it for months and I've saved up and I've worked really hard for it. So now I'm like, I'm buying that jumper or I'm buying that pair of shoes, and I'm like, I'm wearing it and like that feeling, that knot in your stomach that you talked about, it's still there with some of this stuff. They're like tiny little micro traumas throughout our lives, aren't they? That we get stuck on and they come back to haunt us.
But, 100%.
Yeah. I mean, let's move it forward a little bit, mate, because the big incident in your life, it almost feels like with the crash that you were in, there was a before and an after, like a defining moment for you, mate. But when did that happen? When were you in that accident?
Yeah, obviously my accident was 24 years ago, 20th of August 1999. And the physical injuries I had horrendous. Obviously, I was in a coma for a number of weeks, and my family were told on numerous occasions that if I wake up, I'd have severe brain damage because they could see the shadows on my scans. They said, be prepared that if he wakes up, he's not going to be able to recognize anyone, walk, talk ever again. So I woke out of my coma. I remember who people were, but they told me I'd never walk ever again. So I said to the doctor, I guarantee I'll walk at the hospital. And he said, he won't. I said, I guarantee I'll walk at this hospital. And I did. I learned to walk. It took me about, I think it was 2 weeks to learn something like 2 weeks to learn to walk again. So, the physical injury I were awful, but the mental health I suffered then afterwards, unbeknown really to me, was really difficult. And then back, the changing point for me, I suppose, I had counselling about 14, 15 years after my accident, and people said to me, what's wrong? PTSD. The woman I saw was amazing because I was offered counselling after my accident, and I was 21 at the time, cocky, arrogant, and I thought I'd see somebody in a white coat. They would judge me, psychoanalyze me, get inside my head. I said, I don't want to see that. I couldn't see it. I didn't want to see a professional. I couldn't talk to my family because, A, you're putting them through enough as it is, and secondly, we just don't talk about things. So I bottled it up for years and years and years. And I went to see a counsellor, and she said to me after the first session, I know what's wrong with you. I said, what, PTSD? And she goes, no, you're grieving. I said, grieving? That's when somebody physically dies. And she goes, no, you haven't got to physically die to grieve. So all I've heard of you today now is, I used to play rugby. I used to do this. I used to, I used to, I used to. You're grieving for your whole life. And she goes, well, to grieve, people, you haven't got to die to grieve. I said, people grieve a loss of life, a loss of the person they were before, a loss of identity. Grieving is a huge thing, which people don't really talk about. So I was grieving my whole life. And she said to me, people, when they give birth, for example, they grieve, even though it should be a happy, joyous time, they grieve because they can't go out as much, they haven't got as much money. They do grieve their whole life. So grieving is a huge thing. So that really, I was in the grieving cycle, I think. I was stuck in anger, depression. Why did it happen to me? I was stuck in that area for many, many, many years. And then I met my partner about 4.5 years ago, and she'd had trauma in her life, but she walked around so happy, positive, bubbly. When she walked into a room, she's so like happy and everything. And I thought to myself, why am I walking around like bitter, resentful? I want to be like her. And she didn't let her trauma define her life. Whereas me, I was looking back all the time where I'd lost. Whereas she's not. She's always looking forward all the time. And then that was one thing. She's a huge part of my life, a huge part of my journey. But also meeting the man who saved my life last year. I met the doctor who saved my life, or professor, I should say, Professor Hamish Lane. I met him last year. I walked in and he said, wow, he said, you're a miracle. We thought you were going to die on so many occasions, he said. Look how big and strong you are, he said. It's incredible. You're a miracle patient, really. So you've got to start talking about things and sharing your story. And I didn't tell me I had to. But so he gave me a kick on the backside, really, thinking, yeah, what am I down about? Do you mean, because for years, I had a good job. My body was fit. I looked all right. I had a nice girlfriend, a nice family, but I was still walking on missing something. Like a purpose, I suppose. Why am I still here? So meeting that man last year was I thought to myself, yeah, what am I? A lot of people out there would want what I got, to be honest. They want the life I got. I got good money coming in. I got everything. I'm healthy. I think so. Meeting my partner then, and the doctor really gave me a kick on the backside. I needed to start looking at my life, looking forward and everything.
Yeah. What did you track the professor down and what inspired you to kind of go looking for him, mate?
It sounds a bit creepy, but I did track him down on Google. I haven't spoken for 24 years, but I wanted to speak to him for a long, long time, just to shake his hand, really, and say, thank you for saving my life. I know it wasn't just him, it was a team of people, but he was the main surgeon, I remember. And I tracked him on Google, and I found out where he was working. And I sent him a nice long email saying, you probably don't remember me. And he said, yeah, of course I remember. He sent a nice long email back. I said, like, can I meet you and chat to you and say thank you, really? So I went to meet him last year. He works now in university in Swansea. He's a director there. And I went to meet him, and like I said, he said he's amazing. But also, as well, I didn't realise his partner at the time, his current partner, she was my main physio. He was the person who taught me to walk again. So these couple are like a power couple. So he saved my life, and she taught me to walk again. So between the two of them, they're just amazing people. So to me, they're like a real life superheroes to me, to be honest, like a god to me. I look at this guy, I met him a couple of weeks ago as well, because I'd done some filming for BBC Morning Live. And like when I met him again, and every time I see this guy, it's like you and your dad. I go into like a little child. I'm not a shy person. I'm just like, I'm quite loud and bubbly. But when I'm around this guy, something happens to me, and I just can't explain what it is. It's weird. I go like into so much admiration and for this guy. It's incredible. Like, do you mean? And I get emotional talking about it. But yeah. So sorry, right? So this guy, like, so when I met him like a couple of weeks ago, I just been filming for BBC Morning Live, and I haven't seen him for a while. This is last year. But it's wow. When I see him, I just, wow, this guy is like, he's a hero. Do you mean? And People like Jobs and celebrities, they're not heroes to me. I don't mind that. It's good of their jobs. This guy, he's changing people's lives and saving people's lives. And to me, that's amazing. Yeah. So, that was the kickstart I wanted, really. It was them two things in my life, I suppose. And I thought, it's something called post-traumatic growth. Like, so to me, I know people growing off the back of a trauma. If you've got like Paralympians, for example, who lost a leg in Afghanistan, don't get me wrong, it's awful. But on the back of that, they're winning gold medals in the Olympics. Off the back of their trauma, they're doing great things. They might not have been good enough to represent Great Britain in the able bodied Olympics, but now they're in the Paralympics winning gold medals. It's like me. To me, I might not have played rugby for Wales, but I'm now helping thousands of people, changing people's lives, inspiring people, motivating people. Whereas if it hadn't happened to me, I don't know what I'd be doing. Probably drunk up the rugby club every Saturday, or I don't know what I'd be doing, to be honest. But now I'm making a difference to the world. So when I lie down on my deathbed, hopefully I'll be a long time away. When I do, I can lie down happy that I made a difference to this world and this planet. So I'm making a difference to people's lives now. I wouldn't have done that before.
Oh, mate, that's beautiful, and I think that just it goes to show what happens when you process that grief and move through the grieving cycle rather than getting stuck on it, how you can start to look at things differently and see the, I suppose, the opportunities,
Massive. There's so much trauma out there. Trauma is such a huge thing. And like, what trauma for me is, it might be a different trauma for you, or a different trauma. Like a broken finger might be a trauma for somebody. Whereas, so everybody's trauma is different. But I personally think everybody goes through some trauma at some point in their life. What that is, I don't know. It could be any trauma. It doesn't have to be a car accident. It could be anything. Let's say a broken finger. It could be anything where your trauma is. But I think the emotions off the back of a trauma and how you deal with it are similar. So, I mean, the emotional side of it, how you think about that, you can either let that trauma define you, or you can, pick yourself up and think, yeah, I'm going to make the best of it. Try and turn it around and try and identify, first of all, you are grieving or why you are where you are, and try and turn it around, use it for good then. There's so many people out there want to help, lots of people out there do good things in life. And so I'm no different to anybody else. I didn't go to university. I'm not, super intelligent. I'm just me. I'm a down-to-earth guy from the valleys. I'm a passionate, raw person, as you could probably tell. I'll never change the person I am. I'll never change. And people say to me, I do talks at the moment, and people say to me, "You're so raw and emotional. I can relate to it. I'm so relatable. Don't ever change the person you are." Like one of the talks I did last week, for example, was a big company down in Dorchester, and there was about, I don't know, quite a few people in the room, and they said they have doctors in there, senior people, scientists, and that, and they said they've never seen so much engagement than off one of my talk. I stood up in front of people. I was raw. I got emotional. I was just me, to be honest, and people loved that. There's people in the room. There's question after question after question, and there was two girls in the room. The director said to me, "These people are quiet. They're in their 30s. They're really quiet. They never speak out, but they put their hands up and ask questions." And they actually admitted in that room they had their own mental health issues as well, which nobody in that company knew about. So I created such a safe space in that talk, and I was so relatable. They actually felt comfortable to open up in front of their whole employees and said they struggle with their mental health as well. So that's what I mean. My talks, I want to be powerful, impactful, and relatable.
Yeah, it's that relatability, isn't it? When someone sees a little bit of what they're experiencing in your story, that's when the connection, that's when the spark, that's when people go, all right, well, Andrew is now in a position where he can do this, but look where he was. And if he can do it, maybe so can I do it. And it just gets that little, it's the absence of hope, which is the scariest thing when it comes to mental health struggles, right? And seeing someone that you can relate to, that you see yourself
Yeah.
in. That can just give that little flicker of hope, and that's kind of what makes the difference, isn't it?
Yeah, it is exactly. I'm a normal guy, and I said I'm just a big, strong guy, like typical. Like, people look at me and think, "Oh, he's strong, he's big. I'm a doorman. I've been a security person." Yeah, but it doesn't make me weak. Talking about my feelings and emotions, like my partner, I met her. She showed me that I can still be strong and big and strong, but it doesn't make me weak to show my emotions and talk. So her two children she had, she liked the fact that I was around. They were around an alpha male, if you like, but also he wasn't afraid to show his emotions either. So they're getting the best of both worlds. So like, people see me now and like, it's, oh, he's big and strong. On the traitors, for example, I had no game plan in there. I went in there as me. I went in as myself, and people could see that on telly. I got emotional on telly and big on telly, and people, hundreds will message me now all the time, like doormen, security people, gym goers, and say, "If you can do it, so can I." So exactly, anybody can do it.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like you've had to learn to do that, Andrew, and kind of learn it to some extent the hard way.
Yeah.
Up until like recent years, was that 20 odd years of masking this and pretending? And what was that period in between like?
It was just me going through my life, bumbling through my life. I was being strong, smashing the gym. Even so much so, I lost my identity. About 5 years after my accident, I went back to play rugby as well. So, and you know, against the doctor's advice, went back to play rugby, which is quite a physical sport with a head injury. It's not the best sport to play either, I suppose. But you know, I went back to play rugby. But looking back, after I've done a lot of self-analysis and work the last couple of years on myself and on mental health and all that sort of thing. And looking back, I think, did I go back to play rugby to try and be accepted again as a rugby boy, as my part of my family, or did I do it because I wanted to do it? And I think probably it's the first one. I think I went back to play because I wanted to be one of the rugby boys, you know, one of the, my identity, get my identity back again for the total wrong reasons. I put my health at risk. My mother and father didn't want us, were not happy at all because you know, they sat at my bedside for 4 months when I was fighting for my life as well for the first couple of weeks. And to go and play rugby is very selfish, I think, looking back. I went to rugby, you know, they were devastated. They weren't happy at all about it, to be honest. But looking back, I thought I did it for all the wrong reasons. I went back to play to try and fit into my rugby boy friend circle again. Do you know what I mean? So it was the wrong reason I did it. Yeah, but yeah. So my journey was I wore a mask again for years and years and years. I tried to get my mask back by going to rugby again, but no, I took my mask off now. I'm just me. I'm accepting me where I am, and that's who I am now. I think everyone wears a mask at some point in their life. Every single person you meet wears a mask. I don't know what that mask is, but everybody's going on sometime. I
Yeah,
wore a mask for 20 odd years.
when you're not okay and you're pretending you are okay, like the amount of like emotional energy that that takes to maintain that day to day. Like for me, that a very similar situation, and I'd wear my mask and I'd go to work and I'd be a dad and I'd do all these things, and then in the moments of quiet, which I tried really hard to avoid, then that mask would slip off, right? And then everything had come spilling out. And be, you know, because I'm a man, the only emotion that I was comfortable with anger. So I didn't get sad. I'd get cross and I'd smash my kitchen up, or do you know what I mean? Or I'd shout or I'd throw things. It kind of it by me trying to mask all the time, that behavior started coming out in a lot of other really inappropriate ways. And now I look back and I think that's kind of, I was kind of like screaming for help. But if you're not telling people that you're struggling, if you're not asking for help, how are they supposed to know, right, that you need help? Like it's such a funny thing. Did the wearing the mask for you, did that take its toll, Andrew, to some extent?
Yeah, similar to what you said. Yeah, I'm, you know, it's heavy. Well, it's really heavy on my shoulders. And like, I put a video on Facebook before the Traitors, but I wanted to do mental health and help people before the Traitors come along. And the reason I went on the Traitors is to show people, obviously, you can achieve great things in life and you can do things in life. And I wanted to use that to be honest, selfish way to create a platform for me to talk about it. To get a platform I got now would have taken me for years, if ever, you know, if I did it on my own. But before the Traitors come along, I put a video on Facebook last year. And I had 26,000 views, I think, in the first couple of weeks on Facebook. And basically, I put a video on there talking about my feelings and my emotions and where I'd been for the last 20 years. I was thinking, and the number of people who messaged me saying, "I can't believe it. You were so happy walking around all happy. I never knew you were going through that." I said, "Yeah, what do you expect?" I said, "I'm going to be walking around crying in the streets, or I wasn't going to like, you know, a grey cloud doesn't follow around with thunderbolts coming off. It doesn't work like that, mental health." I said, "But you don't see the days I was lying in my bed crying in tears, didn't want to go to bed. You know, I dragged myself to bed every day to get on my life to try and lead a normal life. I go to work every day and things. It was hard work, get up every day. I go through months sometimes where I didn't want to get up in the mornings. I wish I was dead. I wish I wouldn't, wish I died in my accident. I'd say horrible things to myself." And but nobody ever saw that side of me. Not even my family really saw that side of me. Only I'd see that in my bedroom. So you mean so and nobody ever sees that. And that's quite common, I think, where people put a mask on, they get up every day. You know, people function every day, but they're still struggling. There's normally the people with the biggest smiles on their faces or the biggest houses, the best jobs. We're struggling with their mental health, really.
Mate, that's so
But,
true, isn't it? You know, and if you're good at pretending, you can kind of like you can have good times in amongst the bad times. So if you pretend for long enough, like I often say to my wife, I often feel quite bad about my behavior when I was poorly, right? And I had about 4 years where I was knocking around crisis points, and I feel really bad about it. And she, one thing she always says to me is that you have to remember that, like, in amongst all the shit, there was also some good times as well. You know, we had a family holiday, and you know, I managed to hold it together for the whole holiday. We had days out, trips to the zoo, go to the park, all these different things. So there are times when you hold it together enough to have a couple of good days, and then you think like, oh, maybe I've cracked it, you know, maybe like that was all right, maybe I've got my shit sorted, maybe I don't need help. And then you don't go for help, and then eventually it kind of comes back around and catches you up, doesn't it?
I think I said it's like a trauma, I think, isn't it? Unless you deal with your trauma, I think you can only put it away for certain long. And it's something, it'll trigger it one, you know, there's always a trauma inside you. And I think unless you deal with that trauma, it might come back in 1 month, 6 months, 6 years. But it's always going to, unless you deal with that trauma, it's going to come back and bite you on the ass, to be honest. You're like, I saw a guy the other day, for example, and he's a fireman. And he said he witnessed three traumatic incidents in a 12-month period. He witnessed a decapitation. I think what something happened with a child or something else. I said, what support do you get? What help do you get for that? And he said, oh, I get three generic emails sent to me, the same email at the bottom. It says, please ring this number for help. Said, did you ring the or support? If you feel like you need, I can't remember what I said. Did you ring the number? Said, no, never, nobody ever rings the number. I'm a fireman. You can't ring that number because you don't need employers to know. So I said, what will happen is, unless you deal with that trauma, I said, that's going to be stored away in your memory somewhere. And what will happen, one day, somebody will catch you up on the road when you're driving, or somebody will say the wrong thing to you. You'll either try and take your own life, or you beat your girlfriend up, or you do something crazy. Unless you deal with that trauma, it'll come back. It'll come back sometime, I said. You need to deal with that trauma. And again, I saw another one, a midwife I spoke to a couple of weeks back, and she says to me, like, she delivered a stillborn baby. An hour later, she had another baby, and a normal bit. And I think, you just got to forget about that one before. She says, it's my job. I said, what do you mean it's your job? I said, I understand it's your job, I said. But where's that being stored in your memory bank? I said, do you know what I mean? It's being stored somewhere in this body. I said, one day, so it's all of a sudden, you're going to forget about that one baby, and be all happy and laughing and joking for the next family, because it's a nice occasion. Or just forget about that family who's been brokenhearted. You're going to just put that in the back of your mind and move on to the next one. She said, that's my job. I said, I know it's your job, I said, but like, no, what support do you get? None. Doesn't you get none? Even no support and help with that. Because you can't, obviously, they can't afford it at the moment. They stretch to the maximum. They can't afford it to anybody. So you've got to carry on as normal in your day job, as if nothing. There's lots of people out there who experience trauma. So many people out there who don't get the help and support they need.
That's wild, isn't it? When you think of it like that, and that's right. Going on, like, all in so many different jobs, all around, everywhere, all the time, you know? And it's
crazy.
Yeah, that's heavy when you think of it like that. I think as a society as well, we're always like really focused on the physical more than the mental, right? So you mentioned when you were coming out of your coma, the big thing people were saying to you is like talking about walking again. Well, like, of course, that's really, really important. But the onus is all on, you know, when you're going to walk again, when you're going to do all these physical things. There's no one saying like, well, hang on a minute, this is massive. There's going to be some mental impact, you know, maybe we need to focus on as well. But we're like that, aren't we? It's all onto the next, physical, onto the next.
Yeah, 100%. I personally think the mental health is probably bigger than physical health, I think, personally. Like, to me, you pay a PT to look after your physical health. You pay £100 for a PT to do your physical health once a week, whatever it is. But then, no, you don't look after your mental health. You don't, you know, and I said, people, everybody's got mental health, I said, and you should look after it. The only time people normally look after their mental health or try and do something about it is when something's gone wrong, which is not too late, but that's you're probably better off. I think prevention is better than cure. You're always better off trying to do something every day, whatever it is, do something that could be going for walks, whatever it is for your mental health. You've got to try and keep on top of it all the time, because like I say, it's a sliding scale. Like, I saw a guy the other day, and it's getting better, but this guy is like a managing director of a large organization with 80 members of staff. And I was talking about something, and he said, I don't believe in mental health. I said, pardon? You don't believe in mental health? I said, what is that statement? What? Tell me, explain that to me, elaborate on that. He said, you don't believe in mental health. I said, have you got a brain? He said, yeah, of course I've got a brain. I said, well, right, everybody's got a brain, it's got mental health. Some have got good mental health, some have got bad mental health. We've all got it, I said. It's on a sliding scale. Like, throughout your lifetime, it's going to change on that scale. You'll have a trauma come in. It'll be everywhere on the scale. Some people are better managing their mental health, whereas others are not. We've all got, so to say that is crazy. As a boss of a big company, what chance have your staff got, or your employees got, if the boss don't believe in mental health? It's crazy.
Yeah. It's so easy to forget that, isn't it? Because you kind of, when you are used to talking about your mental health and you interact with a lot of other people who talk about their mental health, it's kind of easy to think that, like, oh yeah, things are changing. And then you meet someone like that and you think, yeah, there's so much outside of this echo chamber where people are struggling. Yeah, very much so, 100%. Mate. Yeah. So how did the Traitors come about, mate? Did you watch the first one? Was it something you were into? Like, how did that come on your radar?
Yeah, I loved the first series, to be honest. I binge watched over 3 days. I think I didn't start watching from the beginning, but my partner was saying, oh, this is a series you want to watch. It sounds really good on this podcast. She listened to a podcast and she said, oh, this story you want to listen to is really good. I said, oh, I don't like reality TV. It's going to be rubbish. They'll go on, we'll give it a go. And then I put it on. We watched it, I think, over 3 or 4 days on iPlayer. We watched it. It was brilliant. We loved it. And then in March last year, then I had an email or a message on my Instagram page, my Strength in You Instagram page, off a casting person saying, hey, we love your story, we like your page, you fancy applying for it? I thought, oh, go on, I thought it was one of the boys joking around, first of all. And then I thought, yeah, go on, I'll try it. So I tried it, then I kept getting through the next round, and then they said to me in August then, we love you, we like you, we like your show, we like your story, sorry, do you want to go on it? I said, oh, I'll try it, go on then. So they flew me up to Scotland then, I was in Scotland there for 4 weeks, nearly in Scotland. So it was a bit surreal, actually, pinching moments sort of stuff.
Yeah,
It's mad.
crikey, that must be. Yeah. Did you have to kind of sit on it for a bit then? When did it finish compared to when it finished on, like when I watched it? You know, was there a gap? Did you kind of know? Was there a time when you're like pretending that, you know, you couldn't say anything about it, sort of thing?
It was in September, it was filmed. And then it wasn't
Right.
on telly. At the end of January, February was on television time. So I had to keep it under wraps for about 3 months, I think. So I had to go back to my normal day job. Well, I still have my normal day job now, but I had to go back to my normal life as well. Not tell anybody because I signed the NDAs and everything. So I can't talk about it. So I just went back to my normal life then. And it's only been recently, it's all exploded.
Yeah. How's that been, you know, for you? Because you've got this interest in mental health, you've got this passion, and you know, you tell your story and it helps people. There's one thing doing that, you know, in your local area, doing it at conferences. There's another thing doing it on like BBC Morning Live, right? Where people are gonna, I mean, I've watched that documentary. It's incredibly moving. It's a wonderful thing, mate. And I'll put links to it
Thanks.
in the episode notes. But that's like it, that's a lot, right? That's, you know, that's a different, it's a different level of awareness that you're starting to spread with that. How, you know, what was that like doing that?
It was amazing to be honest with you. Yeah, it is emotional. Like I said, I'm not gonna. I just want people to, you know, they messaged me after they've come and filmed in the house, in my mother's house and everything. And they followed me and they said, "Oh, do you mind if we show this? Do you mind if we show that?" Look, I said, "I don't care what you show. I want to show everything. I want to be warts and all. I'm real, and I want people to see." Yeah, I'm not gonna sit here and say talking's easy or this. It's not easy. And you know, people say it's easy, they're lying. But I want people to see that it is difficult sometimes. But you can get there if you keep believing in yourself and keep, you know, keep having a goal or keep having good family around you, people to support you. You will get there eventually. It took me a lot longer than I thought, maybe, but I didn't really have any help or anything. I did it all on my own. I tried to do it on my own, but I got there eventually. So, you know, I want to show people. I want people to see the real story, really, and how hard it was. And my mother and father was on the telly. My mother got upset. I got upset. My brother got upset. So it's a real, the good. I liked the edit in a really good way, actually. It was good. They did a good job on that, to be honest. So, yeah, it's great, and that's all I wanted, to be honest. I didn't want to be a celebrity or I'd only recognize in the street. Don't get me wrong, it's nice. I don't care, but I didn't care about that. I did it to try and show people and break the stigma that surrounds about talking and that.
Yeah, I think that's the most beautiful thing, really. It's something that I've enjoyed so much about watching you know, your journey with it and stuff is because, you know, I just to see mental health being talked about on that scale, it's such an important thing. You know, it's like that's such a good way of like reaching people and you know, in this world of influencer culture, you know, where you can kind of like grow a following and use it to sell like crappy stuff. It's just been so refreshing to have someone say, right, I've got this opportunity and I'm gonna do my bit to like to change how the world feels about this thing. It's like it's an incredible thing, man. Like it's been lovely to
Thanks.
yeah, was there any nerves around that? Particularly like when you talked about it on the show and the people that were on the show with you, you know, there's a couple of episodes where you talked about, was there any nerves about how is this going to be perceived or are people, because I mean, it's the traitors, people at Mitre4, like you tell that story and they go, oh, he's only saying that to hide it because he's a traitor, you know, like
Like
it's a funny
the X
environment to
Factor,
be.
you've got to have a sob story. You go on the X Factor. It's always like a sob story to win. No, but no, it's going to be bound to be nerves because yeah, you obviously. I don't know. I don't watch the show until you watch the show, so I don't get to see the show until you see it. So
Right.
I don't get to see the edited version. They don't send me the edited copies and say this is what's going out next week. I get to watch it, so I'm a bit apprehensive. They could edit it to make me out to be like a right meathead, or they could make me out to be a right. I don't know. I don't know. You see some shows over the years they've edited out to be to make people out look terrible. They could have made me out to look bad, but I don't think they're allowed to do that anymore because mental health is so big. I don't think they're allowed to do that. But I think everybody on the show looked. They made him out to look all right. We looked okay, I think. And I come across genuine, authentic, and real, I suppose, on the show. And I think my edit was okay. But there is going to be a bit of apprehension. But to be honest, I've had no negative comments at all, really. I've had no bad feedback. It's all been positive, good feedback I've had, which is what I wanted. And I've had nothing really bad. Nobody's come up in the street and said, oh, nothing bad anyway. No, I had no messages of anybody bad on social media either, to be honest. It's all been really positive. It's had the effect that I wanted.
Yeah, that's a wonderful thing. It shows how the conversations like changed over the years as well, isn't it? And it's more like people are more ready to accept it on that scale rather than coming back with like negativity or anything
Yeah.
like that, mate. Yeah.
Unfortunately, there are people out there. There are going to be jealous people out there, negative people. You're always going to get them in life, unfortunately. And like you touched on it just now with social media, there's so much pressure on people these days because of social media, especially younger people. You know, when I was growing up, I didn't know anybody had a Lamborghini. Nobody had a helicopter on the roof of their house with a swimming pool. But now, if I look at my social media, I think everybody's got that. Everybody's got a six pack. Everybody's got a certain size cup. and a certain figure as a woman. And there's so much pressure on kids these days, but I think we all got a responsibility as parents or as adults to tell kids, yeah, look at the social media. I'm not a dinosaur. I'm not going to say social media is bad. He's not bad. He's got to be able to look at it and take it with a pinch of salt. You know, but what people are seeing, well, everybody's got a six pack. No, they haven't. You're looking at 5% of the world's population on your social media, and the more you're looking at it, the more it's showing you, because the algorithm. But I say, well, you've got to realize that's not true. No, girls got cellulite. People, they don't look like that. I've done photo shoots for bodybuilding and all, training and that. I don't look like that all the time. If you look at me now, I don't look nothing like that now. It's fake tan, good lighting, and baby oil. You know, I look great in a photo tan, but I don't walk around like that all the time. People message me saying, oh, you've got an amazing body. I said, that one photo I have. But normally, if you look at me now, I don't look like that now. You'd be disappointed if you meet me and think I'm like that. I'm not. And like, I think, you know, people, it's crazy. I know somebody who hires out their Lamborghini to people to have photos taken. You know, they have their photos taken. They walk around the corner again, they're all clapped out Fiesta. They don't go home. I'm thinking, that's mad, mad. People are hiring cars and houses. I know somebody else who hires a house where I live. Got a big house with a swimming pool in. You know, film crews, people hire this house off him. People think they live in this house. They go back to their normal two-bedroom, semi-detached house then. But people think, oh, you've got a mansion. They haven't got a mansion. It's bullshit. I said, it's total rubbish. I said, oh, that's what we need to get better. So at the moment, yeah, mental health and people's self-worth is on the floor at the moment because everybody thinks they're failing in life.
That's so true, isn't it? Yeah, that's the job you want. The job you want is to be the guy with the house who rents it out to the people who are pretending to have the house, because he's laughing, right? Because he's getting his money, he's got his nice house, no one knows he is, he has a life of privacy. God, that's the job I want, you know.
But imagine me putting this on my social media, a little two-bedroom terrace house in the valleys with a big fat guy sitting on my settee. Nobody's going to put that on their social media. Nobody's going to promote that or show that. But that's the reality, that's life. I mean, that's the normal life with my little old car outside the house. Nobody's going to show that on their social media. Nobody's going to put that on their story, are they? But that's real life, though. I mean, people are beating themselves up. Yeah, I know people earning 30 grand a year, which is good money. I think they're failing in life. What do you mean you're failing in life? You've got good money. You've got a roof over your head. You're healthy. You're doing well in life. I mean, you're not bad. Oh, yeah, but so-and-so, it's bullshit. They haven't got that. Like Harry of the Traitors, for example, had a photo on a private jet. Everything he owns a private jet. He does not own a private jet. That's a story on his social media. It's mad, honestly. People say, he's got loads of money, he doesn't deserve it. He hasn't got loads of money. He played a fair game, he won the game fair and square, but he hasn't got a private jet on his outside his house. He's mad.
Yeah, I think a lot of people that are showing that lifestyle, they don't have loads of money, they have loads of debt. That's another problem as well, isn't it? It's people trying to keep up and getting into all sorts of bother, trying to have all the stuff, you know? But yeah, you mentioned self-worth there, Andrew. What ideas have you got around improving self-worth? You know, how have you improved your relationship with yourself over the last few years? Because we do, when we're not well, we turn on ourselves. We're so quick to do it, aren't we? It's like you bully yourself, you get in your own head. And how have you learned to big yourself up a bit and to be more comfortable in your own skin and that sort of stuff?
I hated myself for 20 odd years, I suppose. I looked in the mirror and I was like, I can't get away from my scars. They're on my face. So I can't get away from my scars. And every day I look in the mirror, I got to do my hair every day for work. So I'm going to see my face every day. I say some awful things to myself. So the biggest thing I did was stop saying horrible things to myself. So I say some horrible things every single day to myself in the mirror. Things I would never say to my brother or to my son or to my mother, my father, my best friend. I never say it to them. But why do I think it's acceptable to say it to me? So, you know, you might think it's going to be a quick comment, but your brain is going to take that in. Your unconscious mind is going to keep that. And the more you tell yourself something every single day, you're going to believe it. So first of all, stop saying horrible things to yourself. Stop saying horrible things to yourself. As soon as you say yourself thinking it, don't say it out loud. Don't say it to yourself. You know, when people just say compliments to me, you know, your nice eyes, on, I couldn't accept people saying compliments to me. I used to come back with a negative every time. Or they say to me, oh, you've got good arms or a good chest. But I always come back with a negative. Oh, but there's this. Instead of just saying thank you, which I do now, if somebody says something nice to me, even though I never used to believe it, I'd say, oh, thanks. And just leave it at that. Don't even say anything negative. For years, I used to say horrible things to myself. But I think we need to get better. And like in schools, for example, of teaching kids that like physical and, you know, mental health and nutrition and everything is has a massive impact on the things you put in your body, has a huge impact on your mood. There's a massive lot of research done the last couple of years with gut microbiome and friendly bacteria and all this sort of thing. Have a direct impact on your brain and your moods and everything. And it's true. If on a weekend we're eating rubbish all weekend and eating chocolate and drinking, on Monday morning, Tuesday morning, my mood would be really low. I wasn't in a bad mood or anything. I'd just be down and low, I suppose. But it's the educational piece, I think. And in schools, don't get me wrong, it's good to learn about Prince Harold in 1066 and all this sort of thing. But Anyway, I've never used anything in my life, really, like Pythagoras theorem and pi r squared. I'm never going to use that. They should bring a lesson every week in schools, at like half an hour a week or 1 hour a week, about life skills, about percentages, APRs, body, mental health. That would have a much bigger impact on the country in a beneficial way than teaching about, I don't know, English literature or Macbeth. Don't get me, I'm not knocking that. Don't get, I'm not saying take it out of your school. You've still got to have them things. I'm knocking teachers. They're doing a great job. But I think it's much more beneficial to people's mental health, well-being. There's a huge obesity crisis in the country at the moment. Because people don't understand calories. They don't understand things like that. So I think if you taught people in school or at a young age about calories, nutrition, mental health, self-worth, in the future, then they'll be able to help themselves then. So the NHS will save millions of pounds in lots of different treatments, psychiatrists, all this sort of thing. If we learned at a young age the benefit of certain things, I'm not saying train all the kids up to be counselors or psychiatrists, but give them a basic understanding of things. Like, if I was like, if I went to a 13-year-old kid now and said to them, if your friend came up to you now and said they were thinking of taking their own life or they were struggling with their exams, their pressure, what would you do? I guarantee most of them would have a clue. If I was 14 years of age and my friend came to me and said that when I was four, I wouldn't have had a clue what to do. I'm not saying they could diagnose it, but signpost, help them signpost. If somebody comes up to you and says it, go to your teacher or do what do help them. So rather than brush under the carpet and ignore it, and that festers and get worse and worse, help that person and what what to do, what sort of thing to do to help them, to help their kids, help their friends. Exams in school or university, a massive pressure at the moment on people achieving things. Got to achieve these things or in life. That's there's a lot of pressure on people at the moment.
Yeah, very much so. It'd be so much useful, a lot of the things you're talking about there, we had to learn that as adults, and
They
the
were
hard
taught it,
way as
didn't they?
well.
Yeah.
Yeah. So bringing it in when you're kids, it'd be so valuable for later in life, wouldn't it? Yeah, really
You
would,
don't get
man.
teaching, you don't get lessons on any of this in life, do you? But I think, there's a massive debt crisis in the country, obesity crisis. Nobody got a clue about percent APRs or borrowing money, what the implications of that is. So if you got taught this at a young age, there'd be no less debt, less obesity, less suicides. I think, but there's lots of things. If you've got a young age, you're much better. To me, it's mad, and I think that's been brought in schools. The curriculum at the moment, I think it's so outdated. For 30, 40 years too old, I think. To me, I'm gonna go with the educational. I'm not an educational person, but personally, I think it's so outdated. Need to update it and bring it in line 2024 with the current world at the moment.
Yeah, well, we are facing this crisis after crisis after crisis. So that has to be like foundational systemic change to solve that problem, otherwise you just throw in like buckets of water onto massive fires. That's kind of what's
Yeah.
happening at the moment, isn't it? Yeah, very
Yeah, it's
much
getting
so.
worse and worse and worse. This day and age, they say we're more educated now, that we've got access to more information on the internet than we ever have. So why are we more obese than we've ever been? Why are we not so fit? Why is there more, illness than there used to be? Why is there so much debt? If we're so educated now, we've got so access to so much information, we shouldn't be this. We should be fitter, stronger, less, obese, better finances than we ever been. But we're not, we're worse. So something's
Yeah.
wrong somewhere.
Yeah, that's it, isn't it? Yeah, definitely. I think too many, with the risk of putting me tinfoil hat on, I think too many people kind of benefit from us being this way.
Yeah,
There's a lot of people,
100%.
but that's a whole different podcast episode that
Yeah.
we can be getting into, mate.
Yeah.
I'm gonna finish with a massive question. I always say to people, like, what's next? What are you up to? And you're kind of like, I mean, like the possibilities seem endless. You're doing all these things at the moment. Is there any, are you just rolling with the punches? Have you got anywhere you'd like to take it? What's kind of going on for you at the moment, mate? What's coming up?
That's the thing, it's quite hard at the moment, to be honest. I'm not like an entrepreneur or anything. I want to, I like to start my own business eventually one day, helping people with well-being, mental health. But what that looks like, I don't know at the moment. It's life's been so crazy the last couple of weeks. And it's hard because I want to try and capitalize on my platform at the moment because I'm not stupid. In a couple of months' time, when the next reality show comes out, or the trade does not be forgotten about, but I won't be as much in the public eye as well, or I won't be as much, my stock won't be as big, I won't be the hot at the moment, if you know what I mean. So I want to try and make the most of what I can now. The last thing I want is, like, in the future, look back in 12 months' time and think, oh, that was a good ride, but I'm still working and doing my job now, I'm not helping people. So I want to try, I get frustrated, I need to just be relaxed and chill out a minute because I got so many opportunities coming my way, I'm meeting so many great people. If I don't make that, I need to make the most of it now. So I want to try and, like, set up something. And again, it's talking to as many people as possible, doing podcasts, being a company is getting out as much as possible, really, in the public eye, and just talking about it to try and help bring that stigma down. The more we talk about it, the better it can be, really. So that's what I want to try and do. But obviously, I want to try, not in a selfish way, but I want to try and obviously monetize at the end of the day something. I want to be a living out of it. I got bills to pay at the end of the day, and I want to be able to try and, you know, do good for the world and change the world or change this country. But I got to earn a living off it and put food in my mouth as well. So yeah, it's hard. It's, you know, doing, getting, you know, getting out there as much as I can, I suppose, really, but also setting up my own business.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose the, you know, the more people you talk to and the more people you come in contact with, that's when these sparks of ideas just come, yeah, isn't it? And then you're like, right, yeah, that's it. That's what, yeah, I'm going to do. But it's exciting, yeah, mate. It's a beautiful thing. And yeah, it's been lovely to chat to you about it today, mate. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate
it. Thank you. Oh, thanks a lot for having me. Thanks, Paul. Appreciate it.
Big up to that proper mental podcast. A proper mental podcast.